Live from the launching pad in Sedona, Arizona, this is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Dr. Houdini. I would like to welcome you to a truly unique talk show program that focuses on exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Folks, my special guest today is the author of the Millennium Prophecy, Gilbert Erickson. Gilbert explains in his book how Revelation events will unfold in real time to become part of Earth's history. The revelation refers to itself a prophecy. To qualify as a prophecy, there comes a time when it must actually happen. It must come true. The revelation is an event list for the end times for the 7-year period called the tribulation, for the millennium kingdom, and for the new heaven and new earth. When properly understood, you will find that the revelation maps an outline of these periods of time. We are in the end times now, and the correspondence between prophecy and the unfolding of real-time events is uncanny. Gilbert, welcome to the show.
How are you doing?
Pretty good, Gilbert. How are you doing?
Ready for a show. Let's see what we can do here.
Okay, I think we're ready to rock and roll. All right, okay. Well, I had a few emails with you. I did look over your website. I read a lot of your material there, and I thought we'd get into this wormwood science.
Okay.
Okay, so we have this huge celestial body. Are you still with us, Gilbert?
I'm sorry, you were cutting out there. Let me try again.
Okay,
we had a little
blackout interference there, I think. But anyway, wormwood science. You know, I thought we get into that subject here and talk about this. Wormwood science. Now, are you referring to Bode's law, you know, for these planetary and stellar systems?
Yes and no. Bode's law is a kind of a rough approximation as to where you would find the gravitational loops, node rings, positions, or something or other, of the planets, starting with the sun and working your way out, at least theoretically. It's not very accurate. It's just an approximation. A better approximation is actually done by a young man who's a portrait painter, a kind of Renaissance man, and a wizard with differential equations and such, Miles Mathis, and he has a little different take on what Bode's law really should be for the planets. But that's not the issue that we're dealing with when we deal with it in terms of the wormwood science. The problem is that basically, wormwood is a large, heavy iron ball, like a giant cannonball. Mm-hmm. It's probably about the size of Jupiter, so it's going to be very heavy. Probably approximately 7, maybe 8 times Jupiter's mass on the low end, and 10, 12, 15 times Jupiter's mass on the high end. We don't exactly know how much mass it has. Okay? So it's a big iron cannonball. Now, bodies in space orbit usually around something, and they spin on an axis.
Right.
The new plasma physics, the science that's being applied to astronomy, shows how whenever you have a plasma charge, and these space bodies act like really basically like giant capacitors, then you end up with this tendency for a body to rotate on its axis. Mm. Well, wormwood is the second heaviest body in our solar system. It isn't entering our solar system. It's part of our solar system. It is literally a chip off the old block, off of the sun. Okay? And so Wormwood will orbit the sun, and wormwood will also rotate, just like the planets do, and just like the sun does, and just like other stars do, for that matter. And as it rotates, it will generate these sweet points, or ring positions, if you will, gravitational distortion points, node rings, in space. And the node rings around the sun is where you'll find the planets. That's right. What Bode's law was trying to make an approximation of.
Mm-hmm.
And where wormwood spins in space, it'll produce the same kind of result. When planets spin in space, that's where you find the moons, the orbiting satellites of the planets. So bodies in space that spin on an axis will generate this kind of gravitational electromagnetic distortion. And for planets, you get moons. For the sun, you get planets. And for wormwood, you got space junk orbiting and, you know, flying around inside these node rings. And that's basically the first round, the first source of danger that wormwood throws at us when it's inbound.
Okay. Okay, so we have this huge planetary, or this, would you say that's like a brown dwarf? Or
it's probably a T-series or an L-series brown dwarf star. It is not a planet.
Mm.
It is a star. Now, the Book of Revelation does make that call out.
Yes.
Chapter 8. It refers to it as a star. Now, some translations call it bitterness, and some translations call it wormwood. The use of the term wormwood, or the use of the term bitterness, reflects on its tendency to throw a lot of alkaline chemicals around, probably sulfur types of chemicals. If you taste something that is highly alkaline, it'll have a bitter flavor to it. Angostura bitters will have a bitter flavor. They're alkaline. If you taste something that's acidic, it's going to be sour. So this translation of bitterness or wormwood is a reference to the fact that it throws a lot of these alkaline chemicals around. Could be, you know, perchlorates, or it could be sulfur types of chemicals, but they will tend to have high alkalinity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's described in...
Brimstone is like a sulfur compound.
Well, brimstone is a sulfur compound, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So if we have an eruption, for example, of a volcanic cone that comes up through a sulfur-bearing rock like Yellowstone or something, you can get a lot of brimstone raining down if you get one of those things explode. So brimstone is just sulfur that has come in contact with the air and is hot enough to light up and, you know, and cause a fire.
What,
if you have regular native sulfur and you light it up, it will burn, and it stinks, makes a real choking cloud.
Now, what about this this layer of cosmic dust that they discovered? You know, in years past here, they discovered that the cosmic rays or the cosmic material rain down on the Earth here and build up a little layer of, I think, iridium and other precious metals. Is that related
That would be more a problem that they're having to deal with. I guess was, what's his name, Jeffrey Burbage, the scientist from down in San Diego, where I think he just died this year, who worked out that when a sun goes supernova and it compresses all this stuff, you know, first generation star from hydrogen, and it explodes in the supernova event, there are an array of chemicals and elements that are produced by that compressive explosion, implosion, and then explosion. And that's how we move up the chain, up the ladder from, you know, Big Bang hydrogen and helium to get an array of chemicals for the periodic table of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's produced during one of these compressive, real hard pow, you know, type deals when the sun goes supernova. You end up with this array of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it produces them on a certain ratio. And you would have to look that up, but I think that's under the heading of abundance ratios. So a lot of that stuff is scattered around in various places. We have layers of it here, and we also have deposits of it here. It also shows up in the mantle of the Earth, and probably is in the mantle of Jupiter and possibly in Mars. There's quite a bit of iridium, actually, native iridium. Well, not native iridium, but monatomic iridium in certain alkaline soils on the Earth, plutonic stuff that comes up in weathers. So we actually have a lot more iridium and these rare earth elements, not rare earth elements, but these transition elements than what we thought we had. So, but that's the science of abundance ratios that you get, you know, post facto from a compressive explosion of a supernova event. This is stuff that's taken place, you know, billions of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know this gentleman from the Horizon Project. I don't know if you ever heard of the Horizon Project.
Carrie Cassidy? Bill Ryan?
Oh, that's Project...
Oh, wait a minute. No, that's Camelot. I'm sorry. The Horizon Project. Who are you referring to?
God, Brent Miller. That's his name, Brent Miller.
No, I'm not familiar with him.
There was a clip that Sheldon Day put together that had an interview, I think George Norrie interviewing Brent Miller. And he was talking about there's these periods that they discovered of this layer of this cosmic material that somehow, I don't know if it's a wormwood event that causes this or what, but he seems to think that a wormwood event is involved in this, where the cosmic particles come down onto the Earth, where normally they would be shielded away from the planet. They come down onto the Earth.
Well, okay, that's going to be a separate problem. Maybe we should deal with that. In addition to the node rings that wormwood would generate by virtue of its huge mass and its spin on an axis, mm-hmm. as well as its orbit, it probably is at least mildly volcanic, similar to what we have here on Earth. Now, as you know, the nuclear decomposition down, way down at the core of the Earth makes a kind of a molten iron core for the Earth. It's kind of a slow burn. All elements break down over time. And the core of the Earth is, you've got all this trapped heat that is generated from the nuclear breakdown of the iron and a few other things.
Mm-hmm.
And from time to time, then that pierces through or erupts through the mantle and through the lithosphere right up to the surface, and you get, you know, volcanoes and stuff, okay? And there's a lot of iron and junk in them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's so much iron, you can even get a magnetic signature to tell what the magnetic, where the north and south was oriented at the time that that volcanic rock froze,
okay?
From liquid state to freezing. And it leaves a magnetic signature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wormwood is probably volcanic. This is my best guess. Now, remember, we're trying to project common sense projections based on some other kinds of things that we have seen and observed in, you know, planets and stars. And if wormwood is volcanic, and it has a lot of iron oxide and probably some sulfides and, you know, just, again, mostly just a big iron cannonball, mm-hmm. but it has some of this other junk in it, similar to the mantle of the Earth or, you know, the composition of the core of the Sun or maybe the core of Jupiter, whatever. Then as it erupts with these, you know, volcanic eruptions, and it has this massive, huge EM field, you take a big iron ball like that,
uh-huh.
charge it up with a little plasma from space, and then spin it,
right.
and you have a giant kind of an electromagnet,
mm-hmm.
kind of similar to a homopolar motor. You're an electrical engineer, right?
Right.
Okay, yeah, well, that's something you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, then what you have then is a kind of a homopolar motor, and so... it'll be receiving energy, plasma energy, in the at the poles,
mm-hmm.
and it will be radiating that out at the equator. Now remember, it is radiating that out at the equator, but it is oriented on its elliptical orbit at 90 degrees to the orbit of the ecliptic plane. And that's where the Earth is orbiting,
okay,
with the other planets. Now, the ecliptic plane is not perfectly flat, but it's close. And I think astronomers just doing a little statistical averaging based on the mass of Jupiter, and they call that the plane. But it's close, you know, within a few degrees, this way, that way, and so forth, 4 or 5 degrees, 7 degrees, whatever. But the point is that Wormwood then is oriented at 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, and then its axis of spin would be at 90 degrees to its orbital plane. So it has an orbital equator that aims its moving node rings at 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane, where we are, and then it has this volcanic activity and this supermassive electromagnetic charge. So it's a nasty piece of work, and it has this tendency to loft this ground iron oxide dust electromagnetically into a kind of a disk, like a giant saw blade. So you'll have these sweet point node rings, and then in between, especially in the inner rings, you'll have like a rusty, dusty disk, kind of like a giant saw blade. That's the best way to describe it, like a table saw.
I love that analogy.
Well, it lets you visualize. If you would take a piece of, if you would take a very fine paintbrush, and don't do this while the table saw is running, but, you know, just run the blade up and just hold the paintbrush in one position with some paint and rotate the blade with your fingers. Don't turn the thing on when you're doing it with your fingers. And just paint a set of concentric rings. Okay? Let it dry. Then you can turn it on. And then there's the concentric rings spinning. That's an example of the node rings of Wormwood spinning at 90 degrees to the table saw, which is the ecliptic plane. So you crank the handle, and up comes the saw through the ecliptic plane.
Right.
And you crank the handle, and down goes the saw back down through the ecliptic plane. And that's a pretty good action, a pretty good way to describe it. And then if you want to see what it looks like, go to the website, millenniumprophecy.com. And, you know, there's an animation there that shows that
kind of
twirling and cutting action.
Yes. Now, I also noticed that where this this Wormwood enters our ecliptic plane, goes over our northern hemisphere, then comes back down again, entering the other side of the ecliptic plane, it takes 3.5 years?
That's going to be my best guess, yeah.
Three and a half years.
No, wait a minute. This is based on the Book of Revelation.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what we have to do with the revelation, that we're hit with several problems, how to handle the Book of Revelation. My main discovery as a commentator for how to handle the Book of Revelation, one of the keys to understanding the book, was that the Book of Revelation was in its correct linear order, presentation order, for the most part. There's an exception, like in chapter 11, but for the most part, the way that it unfolds in pretty much a straight linear order. There's an exception, like I say, chapter 11, with the story about the two witnesses. It talks about the end of their ministry, but it does specify that their ministry has been going on for 1,260 days. And then it tells you the story about the death of the two witnesses. And these are a couple of mighty preachers. There's some people believe that these two men, they're referred to in the Old Testament as the sons of fresh oil, literally. They are the ones who empty out the ceremonial oil right in front of the, you know, the throne of God the Father. And so they have an important ceremonial function. And he dispatches them from the throne room, and they go straight to Jerusalem when the Christian church is removed. They minister for 1,260 days. So in chapter 11, you have an out-of-order kind of looking event, because it talks about the death of the two witnesses at the end of their 1,260-day ministry. But other than that, for the most part, the revelation is in order. So what you have is a series of Wormwood events leading up to the beginning of this seven-year period, and then it gets very intense in chapter 8. Then you have another set of events associated with Wormwood, and those events are after the half line period, if you would, after the 3.5 year period, mm-hmm. starting in the second 3.5 year period, and then all of a sudden you have another set of wormwood events, and that's chapter 16. So the revelation as given is close to straight presentation order. That's kind of my free commentary, if you would. The way that it works is you kind of have to keep, you have to preserve the revelation order. I know there's a lot of people out there who will scream, well, you can't do that, you can't do that. Well, actually, yes, you can. And if you do it correctly and you parse the scripture out correctly, then that's what you get. You have a set of wormwood events at the beginning of the seven-year period, then another set of events after the 3.5 year mark. So it's roughly, not exactly, roughly 3.5 years. That's the best I can tell.
Mm-hmm. What about the trumpets? It seems to me that the trumpets are wormwood events. And also...
They are.
Then also includes this Antichrist that makes his appearance. I think after these devastating effects of wormwood, then they come out of their bunkers, okay, with this New World Order. Okay, and his Antichrist that makes his appearance here.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, okay. Remember, if we're gonna use this straight up linear order, then we have to have a linear order that when it unfolds in real time history, the two will synchronize correctly. And I think that's what I've done in my book, The Millennium Prophecy. I show how it comes about physically. I'm a little bit off on the dates, but I think I'm pretty close on the interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So, in Chapter 8, what you have is a set of wormwood events. Okay, that's the trumpet judgments.
Right.
Okay, but there's a couple more of them that occur in Chapter 9. Those are not wormwood events. In Chapter 9, you have the release of this fallen angel who is Satan's best bud,
mm-hmm.
probably an archangel or something close to it, and is referred to as Abaddon the Destroyer,
right.
Or Apollyon,
right.
The Destroyer. That's right. He's a fallen angel.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So he is released out of prison. There's, Satan goes to the throne room of God the Father, and God hands him the keys to the abyss. There's it's a transdimensional prison, and it's right here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow it interfaces with our dimension of time-space. It's referred to as the abyss, but the door is here on Earth. Okay, God the Father hands the keys to Satan, and Satan then goes, and the angel that guards the door to the abyss is taken out of the way. Paul refers to that in Thessalonians.
Mm-hmm.
And he's allowed to go off guard duty because his prisoner is going to be let out. Satan opens the door, and out comes his best bud. And that's where you have this fallen angel who is released from his prison. Now, that's chapter 9 of the Revelation. Associated with this release of the fallen angel Abaddon the Destroyer, Apollyon the Destroyer, is this plague of the poisonous locusts. And that's going to be a first, something that probably a new insect species that nobody's ever seen before. They're described as locusts, but they have some kind of an ovipositor or a stinger or something with a formic acid cocktail or some darn thing and a viral something or other mixed in with this stinging cocktail. And when you get stung by one of these things, you get just the horrible burning sensation where the sting is, like the sting of a scorpion is how it's described. And then you get sick for 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
You have a viral infection for 5 months. So this is Satan's gift to mankind, is to be stung by these poisonous bugs of some sort, insects, that have this poisonous viral laced cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mess. And it says everybody on the earth is going to get stung except for the 144,000 witnesses that God has reserved, you know, to preach in his name.
Mm-hmm.
So, imagine being stung by a bug nobody's ever even seen yet, because these are going to come out of the abyss. when Satan is allowed to release his friend, his buddy, then these bugs come out. That's how you know that the spirit of Antichrist has been allowed out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's what will happen. And then the other thing that happens in chapter 9 is war in the Orient. The PRC goes to war, and they basically just, they want land, arable land and resources. And they just take over the Orient. So
now,
you figure everything
the,
from Korea around through, I'm not sure what if they'll take Japan.
This is
I absolutely know they'll take, they're absolutely going to take Taiwan. That'll be the first thing they go after.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, you know, all the way around all of Southeast Asia, they'll take that, probably Indonesia. And all the way around to Iran.
Well, you know,
they will take Iran.
They're destabilizing those countries between China. See, I figure they're after China.
Who is?
The globalist.
They can't. They're having trouble with that. They're not doing very well. They might want China. They've done everything they can to bribe China and bring China along, bring it into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But China's a little bit beyond their control.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Hmm. Well,
yeah.
You know,
and so during this period, the Chinese show what they can do, their massive muscle power, and the Revelation refers to, you know, this nation who can raise up an army of 200 million men.
Right.
Well, there's only one nation on planet Earth that has an army of 200 million men.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one. There is no other. Nobody else has that kind of an army.
Well, you know, the way that I see it is that they're destabilizing all those countries between Israel and China to get China to march that 200 million man army towards Israel. And I think the only way they can do it is to destabilize that region.
So that I don't think it's going to work that way. And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to call you down for this, but I'm going to contradict you.
Okay.
And I'll take you on thusly. Here's how we do that. Basically, when you look at how the Revelation describes it, it says that there are four fallen angels who have been sealed in some kind of prison cells or something that are located somewhere along the Euphrates River. Now, the Euphrates River is 1,700 miles long, so that doesn't give you a real exact geometry and, you know, in terms of what the location of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But these four fallen angels, also possibly, you know, fallen archangels, we really don't know. Very powerful. These are extremely powerful beings. Are allowed out of their prisons. Now, they're not in the abyss. They're in some other kind of prison, some holding cell.
Mm-hmm.
And it refers to them as being released. This is release the four fallen angels. And so they're released. And that they make a beeline straight to China. And in my mind, what that means is, you know, the Chinese right now are just pursuing their own economic global interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't be faulted for that any more than we can or any other nation can to act in their own best interest is ultimately the, you know, the most stable way to have predictable operating outcomes for things.
Mm-hmm.
So you have four fallen angels who suddenly show up, massively powerful individuals, massively powerful, and they're the ones who stir up the patriotism or jingoism or lust for conquest or bloodlust or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Pick a title, any name you want. And the in a way, the Chinese are just as much a victim of it because they don't realize what's happening. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
And as you've got these powerful creatures who are unleashed against them, they are satanic cohorts.
Mm-hmm.
And as satanic cohorts, they are capable of doing some extreme damage. They have tremendous power over the minds of men. And they head straight for the communist Chinese and try to stir up the People's Republic of China and say, oh, stop doing this, it's time to go to war. And so that's what happens. The Illuminati, you know, they can try their little games and play some stuff. And within certain economic circles, they're pretty good. The Rothschild family has their fingertips touching, what, about 52% of the world's money?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of influence. Yeah. But in terms of being able to stir China up, they can't do it. But when these four fallen angels are allowed out of jail, somewhere, again, somewhere along the Euphrates is all that, you know, it doesn't say exactly where, just somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit town. Then all of a sudden, now you've got the PRC mustering out 200 million men. Now remember, under the PRC rules, the 200 million men, the only way to support that, this massive army, is to have the captains of the army also be captains of industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it means for them that they have to stop producing the goods that they're producing for the world and for themselves, and then they have to go out and do war. They have to do war instead of production. What the Illuminati have done is basically finance that, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So Western nations and westernized nations and any other nations that trade with or that consume Chinese manufactured goods are financing what will be this future mustering out of Chinese forces.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual mustering out will be done by some extremely powerful, rather evil, angelic creatures with tremendous mind power. The world has not seen these kinds of things yet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't have an analog for Abaddon the Destroyer running around and destroying planets. We just don't have. We've never seen anything like that before. Not in written history.
Mm-hmm.
These creatures have been kept bound up in prison for a reason. But during this period of tribulation, they're allowed out. And the tribulation is not a very nice place to be living on planet Earth.
It seems to me that if they're bound here, they caused trouble before.
I'm sorry, do what?
To be bound here means that they caused trouble before on the Earth, it seems to me.
They probably have caused trouble,
mm-hmm.
and that's why they're in jail. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're not allowed out to roam around and do what they want to do, because they're badasses. They're bad creatures.
Okay, so good.
They're bad people.
So good.
They're not nice people. They're bad people.
Yeah. Well, we know that the Earth is a prison planet.
No, we don't. The Earth is a creation just like all the other planets. Yeah, I don't buy that. The difference probably for our Earth versus other planets, if I had to make that distinction, is that Earth is a satanic principality.
Okay.
Satanic principality. Let me elaborate a little bit on that. During the temptation of Christ, when Satan confronts him, the third temptation, you know, first the bread and then all this other stuff. And then the third temptation is he shows him the all the kings of the world. He says, all these kingdoms are mine. I can give them to whoever I want. I'll give them to you if you will bow down now and worship me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's very telling is the response that Jesus makes. He said, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. In others, it's really interesting that he does not challenge Satan's principality rights, his right to give control of the kingdoms of planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That is not challenged. Basically, it's a form of admitting, yeah, you're right, you do have that. But the answer to your offer is no. Okay, so Satan has principality rights here. Now, he has to operate within certain limits. There's a leash on him. He's allowed to go only just so far. But the people who suck up to it, they're his victims. They belong to him. Now, where would we find that? Answer, the book of Job. In the book of Job, the first couple of chapters, you know, in this dialogue between God the Father and Satan, God the Father baits Satan with a challenge. Have you considered my servant Job a perfect and upright man? Righteous. He's a good guy. Well, come on, Lord. You know, you've built a hedge around this guy. I mean, he's rich. He's popular. He's got it easy. Come on. You've blessed him. Let me take all that stuff away and I'll bet you I can make him curse you to your face. Really? Yeah. Sure, I'll make him curse you. So God gives him permission. Now, what's God betting on? his relationship with Job. He knows better. Satan sashays forth, you know, and does the destruction. Doesn't work. At the end of it, Job says, "Naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked I'll return there when they bury me. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And he said, in all of this, all these problems, Job did not sin with his, you know, with his lips. He did not curse God. Okay, he had reason to, but he didn't. He blessed the name of God, the Creator. He knew the difference. Now, observe, when it talks about Satan being summoned to have to give account for himself, it talks about the sons of God. Okay? They're gathered. They had to give account. So when he gets to Satan, now, Gilbert, God says, what have you been up to?
Gilbert,
I've been walking to and fro on the earth and all this kind of stuff.
Gilbert.
So,
Gilbert,
yeah.
I got to hold you right there. Okay? I got to stop you right there. The sons of God. They are the Elohim, the ETs, the Elohim.
Well, actually, that's probably a pretty good guesstimation. We don't know. The Elohim angels, the creator angels.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know what the structure is because that is not revealed in Scripture. But that is possible, yes. Not necessarily highly probable, not necessarily highly improbable. That would be a good guess, though.
Now, the ET.
There's one commentator who does say that, that is the Elohim angels. That these are the ones that carry the life codes for the various, you know, the various DNA life codes, and they seed the Class M planets with life. All around the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that could be the Elohim angels.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, we don't
above
know,
our
for
heads.
Sure.
You know, these angels and these gods and angels, these are the ETs that are above our heads. And we see
well,
that night vision God.
Yes and no. Just because you see ETs doesn't necessarily mean that they're gods. Let's put that one to rest. The U.S. military, under a kind of a separate hidden space command, has access to vehicles that they reverse engineered, you know, anti-gravity technology. It's not that hard. And so we have our own ETs, but that doesn't make us gods. We're just humans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, be very careful there. When somebody is a genuine Elohim who carries principality rights over some sector of space or something, that's a different kind of... Those are transdimensional beings. Those are not humans in the normal biologic DNA sense with, you know, flesh and blood kinds of things.
Yes.
You follow the difference?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope that makes sense to you.
Okay, well, you know, we originally started talking about Planet X. And
got a little bit further. You guys keep asking questions. You know?
Yes. And we get into Bible prophecy, which is a fascinating subject.
Well, we could always do another interview if you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could do a part two next week, too. Okay, now, where's a good segue into this to get back on track here?
Wormwood science?
Yes, wormwood science. Okay, so we have this body that's coming, this massive celestial body that's coming in here. Now
that's
it's
the sun's.
In.
That would be the sun's little sister,
yes.
The brown dwarf star. About 60 to 80% of the stars, as we look out and start doing our space surveys, are binary.
Mm-hmm.
Some are trinary. Some are binary pairs of trinary complexes, like the Sirius starring Canis Major. Our sun is a binary star. So Wormwood is not entering our solar system. Wormwood is part of our solar system. It is the sun's binary little sister.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think it was a captured object then?
Absolutely not.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it was involved from the original formation of the solar system.
Probably. The way the plasma people look at the model, if you have an increase in the flow, dark mode flow of amperage through the ionic fabric of space, the mostly hydrogen, This is about, what, one hydrogen atom per cubic meter or something like that. If you have an increase of amperage, then what that does is it will speed up the rotation of a star and make it go from orange to yellow to bright white to blue, depending on what the amperage flow is and depending on what the cross-sectional presenting diameter is. So a larger star will, if there's high amperage, it can turn blue, 10,000 Kelvin. If it's a low amperage flow, it may be just, you know, dull red, like Betelgeuse or something. So the point is that when you have this plasma flowing, it can superheat an object so that it will slough off part of its skin, like an onion. It can also pinch it like a belt that is being progressively tightened, tighter and tighter and tighter, and actually squeeze the ball of iron into two balls, making two stars. Or you can have it non-equal, where you get one that's a main star and one that's a, you know, a brown dwarf. It could also be a red dwarf. So they don't have to come out equal. And that's what we have in our solar system. It's a brown dwarf, probably a T-series or an L-series brown dwarf with a lot of sulfur, sulfides and stuff on the surface, and that's why it's hard to see. It doesn't give off visible light because it's not big enough, but it packs one hell of a, you know, magnetic charge, and it gives off an infrared heat signature. So it's visible in the infrared.
Okay.
But it is part of our solar system.
So now when Planet X, you know, enters the ecliptic plane here. Now, do you think it's going to be red or white, or it's going to heat?
Probably a combination, something between red and black, red, brown, and black. It's fairly dark, but when it gets up close and personal and the light of the sun shows on it, it'll probably show up more red. But because it doesn't give off enough heat to generate light and it doesn't have a plasma sphere, you know, photosphere like the sun, it's just not big enough. Can't catch enough juice in this sector of space. It's dark for right now, but when it gets close and personal, according to the Colbrin Bible, when it gets flies over close, you know, flyby, Wormwood takes up something like 1/5 of the nighttime sky as it flies overhead. It's huge.
1/5?
Really, really big.
Oh, that's
really big.
That's going to be scary looking.
Well, it probably is very scary looking.
Oh.
And when it throws methane gas down through our atmosphere and throws those little igniter pellets, and
it
burns up or incinerates a third of the Earth, that's going to be really scary too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't this the part of the
scary stuff
where they talk about men's hearts failing? You know, when when they look at this thing in the sky, I mean, it is going to be scary looking.
Yeah, I believe that was in the Gospel of Luke. It says men's hearts failing them for fear.
Yes.
It was actually in reference to the roaring of the waves.
Uh-huh.
Remember, Wormwood is so strong.
That's
its gravitational torque over effect, it can roll the Earth over on its side.
Yes, yes. That's one thing that I want to get into is the pole shift.
Okay, yeah,
now,
I can do that.
From what I understand, we're going to return back to the days before Noah. So when this thing came through before, it tipped the Earth. Wasn't the Earth's axis at 0 degrees?
It may have been, but we don't know that. We don't really have any information to go by on that score. What we do have magnetic orientations in the frozen magma of various volcanic eruptions around the planet, that we've got something like 200 some odd different magnetic orientations showing that at least the magnetic poles have shifted before. Lots of times. What we don't have is the ability to say that the actual axis of the Earth has changed from 23.45 degrees to 23.45 degrees from 0 degrees. Maybe that was true. Maybe we, you know, in the days of Noah, the Earth went straight up and down, and Wormwood rocked it over. because that is entirely possible.
But then it's going to return back with this next passage.
Not necessarily. It might or it might not. The real, I'm going to have to take you to task on your interpretation of that, too. That is possible, but not necessarily highly probable. Because what it's referring to there, it says, as in the days of Noah, it says they were marrying and giving in marriage, and
yeah,
they were, you know, doing commerce, going about their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the days of Noah, they were doing some things, you know, and it describes what the Genesis describes, you know, what was going on in those days. Not all of it was good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The sum of human behavior was getting pretty raunchy. And so in a way, it's kind of a social commentary as well. And I think it's much more concerned about, you know, human behavior that the satanic influences and these, you know, demonic influences on people were getting pretty raunchy and producing some very negative effects.
Well,
and
you know,
that's what it's referring to about in the days of Noah.
Is
it possible that it could also refer to the earth being
normal.
Spinning on an axis that was vertical? Yes, it could have been. It doesn't have to be, but it could have been.
Normal. Okay.
How I'm sorry?
People react. And, you know, when I look at this verse, you know, out of the book of Matthew, this chapter 24,
mm-hmm.
verse 37 through 39. Okay, 38,
mm-hmm.
it says, people were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered into the ark. I mean, to me, that's normal, typical human behavior. But I think it's describing a passage of planet, or this Planet X, or this Nibiru, Wormwood, at the time of Noah, when it took everyone away, and then it's going to repeat itself now, because officialdom is not telling us the truth of what's going on here, and it's going to happen again.
How about that, huh?
Yeah. I mean, the elite all know what's coming. You know, the high-ranking
mm-hmm.
government officials know. I mean, they're building their underground cities. They moved key
mm-hmm.
elements from Washington, D.C. to Denver. Everybody's
mm-hmm.
moving that knows about this thing to high ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so history's going to repeat itself. Even though we have the technology all in place that let us know that this, I mean, we can precisely calculate this thing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, not a word comes out of officialdom, you know, that this thing's coming.
How about that?
Yeah, and it's
so it sounds vaguely familiar,
right,
doesn't
here,
it?
Right here in the book of Matthew.
Yeah, which chapter was that? Chapter 3?
Chapter 24, verse 37.
Oh, 24.
39. Now, to me, verse 38 is very typical Earth human activity that's going on. And yet 37 describes what happened with the passage of Planet X in Noah's day. And then what's going to happen verse 39, what's going to happen again here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And nothing really has changed.
How about that? Isn't it amazing how government behaves?
Yes, it is. It's very interesting.
You don't listen to what they say. You watch what they do.
Exactly. You nailed it.
See, they're politicians mostly. We don't have very many statesmen in government.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of mindset that would be a statesman. You know, a George Washington, John Adams, these kinds of people, those are statesmen. They're a different class of human.
Mm-hmm.
They think a little differently. They're not just politicians, you know, who are suck-up crowd pleasers. Politicians are go along, get along, but please pay me. These are not people with leadership, and their heart is not in leadership and service. Their heart is, you know, gimme and posing and posturing and you know, that kind of thing. So a politician is a different animal from a statesman. And so what you have is basically a group of, you know, a kind of an in crowd of politicians, and they have to group around and form consensus and do this and that and the other. So to be a politician, you fit in well with that kind of mindset, and until you are confronted with real hard decisions like a BP blowout and massive poisoning of the Gulf of Mexico. And then all of a sudden you got politicians who have to make decisions, and they really don't know what they're doing.
Well, you know who owns
Well, what do you think they're
going
to do when it comes time to face up against Wormwood?
Well, Gilbert, you know who owns that drill hole? It's Halliburton. But you don't hear a word about that.
Well, BP is actually the owner, I think, the operator. Well, the point that Halliburton was supposed to service it. But it wasn't, and somebody screwed up. I think the way that it worked, they didn't have the updated schematic for the blowout preventers, and those things work on thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of wells all over the world, and they have for many, many years. They've ever since the 20s they've used them, because they work. Now, you never hear, there's no news flash when one of them works. You know, you get thousands of wells drilled in a year,
right,
and with 100% containment, never a fire, nothing. The press got and said, oh, the blowout preventer worked. Well, yeah, that's what it's supposed to do, prevent blowouts.
Mm-hmm.
But let one fail. Oh, terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crazy world.
Well, Gilbert, we're just about out of time here. and I got to have you on.
Sorry about that.
I got to have you on for a part two.
Okay. As many as you like.
Okay. In these last few minutes here, is there something you want to talk about? Or
you want to mention? Well, if you have another question, something we can touch on briefly that is bothering you, other than that, I would invite people to go to the website, www.millenniumprophecy.com, and you can always email me if you have questions, author@millenniumprophecy.com. There's a good animation CG there, and also the gallery. If you look at the pictures in the gallery, then study the science page and compare the gallery, the animation, and the information on the science page.
Yes.
All of a sudden, all of this stuff will make sense to you. It's not that hard. You just kind of have to visualize, you know, in your head what's going on. And use those three resources. They're there. They're free. We pay for them, and Media Temple, the host, is very good. You know, they'll never overrun those servers because those guys are really good, and they have dynamic bandwidth. And use the website, study the information, study the long elliptic shape of the orbit of Wormwood, and then visualize, use the animation. You can see that thing as it comes up above the ecliptic plane, and we kind of throw the node rings there with the little space junk so you can see them. And, you know, this combination of information on the science page, the gallery, and the animation, and all of a sudden everything is pretty much clear. Mostly
well,
clear.
I'll tell you, when you factor in Planet X, you know, this Planet X or this cellular object, Wormwood, into the Book of Revelation, it makes sense. Okay, given the all the calamity that this thing causes.
That's a major piece of work. This is the destroyer of civilization.
It's the cleansing. You know, I think that the Hopis talk about...
Well, you know, in light of the behavior of the Illuminati and Masons and the Mafiosi and, you know, all these various subterranean banking elements and all this satanic influence that's being peddled around, maybe it is time for a house cleansing,
yes.
A house cleaning. You know,
so.
And it's really sad because, you know, you're destroying civilization in the process. But God says this is what's coming, and he gave the information heads up 2,000 years ago. So, you know, that day has now arrived, and here it comes, ready or not.
Right.
I just wanted to try to make some physical sense out of it so people could see that when the revelation said this is what was coming, that it was physical. This is a physical reality.
Well, Gilbert, we're out of time.
Okay, well, thanks for the chance to be on your show.
Yes. Fascinating discovery. With Gilbert Erickson. Thank you, Gilbert. So coming up is Michael Elijah and his connection with cosmic beings, the ETs. That's coming up next on Vortex Network News. And